Here's the snap and an end around to Godwin. Godwin running to the 30. He's got the first down across the 40. Bucs are going to win this football game. Byron Leftwich and Bruce Arians dial up the right play. Tampa Bay Buccaneers are going to be the first team ever to host a Super Bowl. The Bucs have punched their ticket to Super Bowl 55.
Super Bowl 55 is set. Tom Brady's Tampa Bay Bucs will host reigning champs Patrick Mahomes and the Kansas City Chiefs in 2 weeks. So while we wait, Bill Barnwell explains how impressed we should be with Brady, what Aaron Rodgers wants from Green Bay, and what went wrong for Josh Allen as Mahomes routed the Bills. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Monday, January 25th. This is ESPN Daily. All right, we got 3, 2, 1. Bill, we did it. We have made it to our penultimate Sunday night episode of the NFL season.
Wait, Pablo, we don't want to give them a timestamp?
Oh, I should point out, it is 10:52 p.m. Eastern time. Thank you, Bill, for respecting the tradition that clearly I had already forgotten in my rush to dive into whatever the hell happened today.
This is all that matters to me. My life just my life in 2020 will just go down as a series of timestamps at which we recorded ESPN Daily.
So let's get into it. I want to start with you, Bill, with the NFC Championship, because to me that kind of felt like watching the careers of two of the best quarterbacks of all time in miniature. We had Aaron Rodgers doing all of this good that got squandered by his own team. And we had Tom Brady looking invincible and then looking extremely mortal, but rolling to yet another Super Bowl with just a little bit of help from the refs. And I feel like we got to start with that yellow flag at the very end, because the pass interference call against Kevin King, poor Packers cornerback Kevin King, It decided the game. And I need you to explain what happened there.
Okay. So the penalty.
Third down, Tampa Bay, third and 4. Minute 46 to go in regulation. Crowd comes to its feet. Brady in the shotgun. Three receivers bunch on the right. Godwin motions. Snap to Brady. Looking around. Brady lofts it over the left side, and it's incomplete. The receiver tripped and fell, and a late flag is thrown on the play.
So you know how dogs can sometimes sense earthquakes before they actually happen and before you actually feel the effects of the earthquake?
Yes, yes.
So when that pass fell incomplete, Pablo, I was the dog. I was the one sensing the oncoming flood of tweets, of narratives, of sports talk show content. That was coming because I knew a flag was coming. And yes, a flag did come.
Johnson, the intended receiver.
Kevin King was the defender, Wayne.
Yeah, it looked like their legs got tied up inadvertently, and I wonder if the officials will review this and maybe pick this up.
And I will say, Pablo, a couple of years ago, I went and I did the research. I looked back through Tom Brady's career, and I wrote a story about the Patriots, and I actually looked at whether Tom Brady gets more calls than other quarterbacks. The answer is no. To be clear, I don't believe myself. I don't believe my research, because I felt very confident a flag was coming here.
Pass interference, defense, number 20. Volley plays to the spot of the foul. First down, Tampa Bay.
Oh, goodness.
If I can be genuine here, let's try and hold two diametrically opposed points in our heads. That was clearly a penalty. And also, I don't think it should have been called. By the letter of the law, Kevin King was repeatedly grabbing Tyler Johnson's jersey from behind. But if that happened in the middle of a game in week 8, in a normal season where penalties are being called at a normal rate, and the refs called that penalty on Kevin King on that third down, not a single person is complaining about that call. It is an obvious, obvious penalty.
But it seemed extra conspicuous, Bill, because, well, it was the NFC Championship game, but also because the game otherwise really didn't have many other flags being thrown.
Yes, that's the thing. The problem, and the reason why I think that they should not have thrown that flag in that situation, is that the refs let every other possible penalty seemingly go in this game. I mean, this was a season where officials have called fewer penalties than ever before. And the first 58 minutes of this game were sort of like a parody of that season-long trend. Fox must have had a half dozen slow-motion replays of receivers being held, shoved, or grabbed at key moments on their routes. There were no penalties at all called until halfway through the third quarter, and that was for offsides. Yes, there was a 12-man on the field penalty, but the refs made one judgment call for the first 58 minutes of the game until that pass interference call with 1:46 to go. It felt like the refs had established that the rules for this game were different than the rules for every other football game maybe these two teams have played, and then changed their minds about it on the most important snap of the contest, if not the entire season, for the Green Bay Packers.
And before that final bad call we just discussed, there was another incredibly unpopular decision, Bill, that could be even more broadly consequential for Green Bay, and we'll get to that in a minute. But we saw Rodgers march the offense down the field, down eight, and then on fourth and goal from the eight-yard line, Matt LaFleur, his coach, elects to kick a field goal. And this just has to feel like a recurring nightmare for Aaron Rodgers in specific at this point. What did all of this feel like to you, Bill?
It felt like a decade of heartbreak repeating itself. I mean, like you said, this is not the first time Aaron Rodgers has had a spectacular season. And after questionable decisions made by his head coach in the postseason. Go back to the Mike McCarthy era. First quarter of the NFC Championship game in 2014, the Packers kicked two field goals inside the two-yard line against the Seahawks in a game where Seattle eventually comes back to win in a dramatic finish. The following year, Rodgers hits a Hail Mary against the Cardinals with 5 seconds left to make the score 20-19.
Rolling left, being chased, gets hit, launches it, middle of the field, in the end zone, it is... Oh my goodness, it's caught! It's caught for a touchdown! You can't be serious! A touchdown for Green Bay! Janis caught it! No time left! You gotta be kidding me! How do the Packers do this twice in 1 year?
Cardinals players in disbelief. The Packers have all the momentum, and McCarthy kicks the extra point to send the game into overtime instead of attempting a game-winning two-point play to end the game right there. The Cardinals scored a touchdown 3 plays later, and the next time Rodgers saw the ball was September. To see Matt LaFleur fall into the same trap Mike McCarthy fell into is heartbreaking, especially because he's been one of the most aggressive coaches in football this year on fourth downs. The Packers were down 31-23 with 2:09 to go, so they needed a touchdown and a two-pointer to tie the game up. On third down, Aaron Rodgers scrambled. He might have been able to score. At the very least, he could have got the ball closer to the end zone and made LaFleur's decision tougher. But after they fell on third down on an incomplete pass to Devontae Adams, Pablo, I don't think it had even occurred to me that they might consider kicking a field goal. But then they sent their kicker out onto the field and Twitter erupted. Everyone agreed, just like that Mike Vrabel call from 2 weeks ago. The Packers kicked a field goal and got within 5 points, but they never got their offense back on the field.
It seemed, Bill, as if millions of analytically minded voices suddenly cried out in terror.
It's as if we weren't able to go on Twitter to complain about people not going for it on fourth down. That's the only thing I can imagine that would have been worse than a team actually kicking a field goal in that situation. Now, I will say, Papa, most of the win expectancy models I saw were closer on this decision than Twitter's vehement, venomous reaction to this kick. And in part, that's because the Packers are in rough shape either way. Down eight feels a lot closer than it actually is, because you have to hit a two-pointer and then win in overtime. Even if you score the touchdown, before that two-point play, you're only looking at a 25% chance of winning. You have to hit both those things to win the game. So the Packers still have 3 timeouts and the 2-minute warning. So LaFleur probably saw a clear path towards winning this game in regulation. Now, the problem with that, and some of the problem with the win expectancy models that are out there, is that they're based on average offenses and average defenses. And the Packers are not an average offense, and they are particularly not an average offense in the red zone. I mean, just think about it from the Buccaneers side. Do you think anybody on the Tampa Bay sideline felt anything but utter and absolute relief when they saw Mason Crosby and the field goal unit come onto the field for the Packers?
Yeah, no.
No, I mean, LaFleur kicked two field goals from the six-yard line in this game. Contrast that to Bruce Arians, Mr. No Risk It, No Biscuit, who earned his biscuits in this game. He helped win the NFC for the Buccaneers by getting aggressive at the end of the first half. The Buccaneers were about to punt on 4th and 3 from midfield, a decision nobody would have blamed them for. Then called a timeout, changed their mind, and converted with a pass to Leonard Fournette. After that, the Packers just needed to keep a Buccaneers team, which was out of timeouts, in bounds on the next play to keep Tampa from scoring. But they called for a single high safety coverage, leaving both sidelines open downfield. Tom Brady managed to find Scotty Miller, who ran past Kevin King for a 39-yard touchdown.
Brady to throw, throws a deep pass downfield. Got Scotty Miller in the open, makes the catch! Touchdown, Tampa Bay!
Those points, that touchdown, and Bruce Arians' decision to go for it on 4th down ended up pushing the Bucs into the Super Bowl.
And now a lot of people are here wondering if all of that is pushing Aaron Rodgers out of Green Bay, Bill. And I know that sounds very radical, but it also feels like precisely what Aaron Rodgers wants us to be wondering based on his post-game comments.
Yeah, Bill, that's a good question. I don't know. I really don't. There's a lot of unknowns going into this offseason now. And I'm going to have to take some time away for sure and clear my head and just kind of see what's going on with everything. It's a grind just to get to this point. And that makes the finality of it all kind of hit you like a ton of bricks.
What do you make of that?
Well, I can't imagine anybody would feel good losing a game under those circumstances. But, I mean, those quotes are despondent. You know, it's really dramatic. And this has been an incredible season for Rodgers. But afterwards, the conversation wasn't about what he and the Packers will do next year. Instead, it was about whether there will even be a next year for Rodgers with this organization. LaFleur was asked after the game if Rodgers will be back. And his answer was,
I sure as hell hope so.
Rodgers is probably going to win league MVP. So this isn't a Drew Brees situation where the guy can't play anymore. There's been no hints Rodgers wants to retire or even feels like he's close to done. And no disrespect, I can't imagine a life of State Farm commercials with Patrick Mahomes are going to occupy all of Rodgers' free time. The complicating factor here is the presence of Jordan Love, who the Packers drafted in the first round this past year's draft. Green Bay clearly thought Love was going to be their quarterback of the future. And when he was drafted, there was speculation he would take over as early as the 2021 campaign. Of course, that was before Rodgers did what he did this year and put together an MVP caliber campaign. That would typically reset whatever time frame the Packers had when they drafted Love to begin with. Now, he has 3 years left in his current deal. So I don't think this is about getting a new contract or getting more money.
So Bill, if this is more than just like a dramatic AOL instant messenger away message, what could Rodgers possibly want at this point?
Just to get some messages from his friends, maybe for his crush to notice him, perhaps.
Yes. We've all been there, for the record. I am saying this from experience.
Of course. Who among us, Pablo? Just from Green Bay's perspective, just on principle, I can't imagine trading the reigning league MVP and a franchise icon after back-to-back 13-3 seasons so they can start Jordan Love, who has zero career pass attempts in the NFL, even by the standards of the 2020 season. That seems pretty far-fetched.
So I want to get to Tom Brady here, Bill, because I know you are a tough grader, and we saw Brady throw 3 picks with the game dangling in the balance after looking like, for a while, the youngest 43-year-old in sports history, as he has often looked. So what grade are you giving Tom after today?
You know, I think he was pretty good. I think I would say a B, which I would not typically say for a guy with 3 interceptions who might have been bailed out by a 2-decade-long conspiracy by the league to prop him up. This is weird. I mean, it just doesn't make sense for a guy who did throw, again, 3 interceptions in what felt like about 10 minutes of real time. But he was pretty good. Brady was 20 of 33 for 280 yards and three touchdowns, and that was with a handful of drops from Evans, Godwin, and Johnson. Unlike Breeze last week, Brady's not showing any sign of a tired arm. If anything, he had more zip on his passes now than he did earlier in the regular season. The interceptions, yes, they were a problem, and I don't think he can afford to do that against the Chiefs in the Super Bowl, but I don't think there's anything wrong with Brady or any reason to think that a guy who does protect the football pretty consistently is going to struggle to do that 2 weeks from now.
All right, Bill, after the break, we got to take a trip to Kansas City so we can better understand how the Chiefs utterly dismantled the Buffalo Bills.
When you're on a business trip, you know what completely goes off the rails? Your workout routine, especially when you book a hotel that doesn't have a gym. So what ends up happening is you do a few push-ups and sit-ups in your room, run around the block, or just skip it entirely. Lame. If you just stay at La Quinta by Wyndham, you'll discover there's a fully equipped fitness center at every location. Now you can wake up and power your buys and tries the right way or de-stress with some cardio. The choice is yours. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book direct at LQ.com.
So, Bill, let's get into the AFC Championship game. And I want to spare a moment at the top here, a moment of silence for our producer, Erin Vale, who just saw her Bills get obliterated by the Kansas City Chiefs.
I know she's not listening to this part of the show.
One more snap. Mahomes goes to a knee. The trophy stays here. The Chiefs are back-to-back AFC champions.
But after weeks and weeks, Bill, of MVP-caliber Josh Allen, we watched the return of bad Josh Allen when it mattered the most. And we saw overthrows. We saw a pick in the fourth quarter. We saw truly massive losses on stacks. And Buffalo just looked bad overall. So what happened there?
Yeah, I mean, Josh Allen was definitely part of the problem. It wasn't his best game. But I don't think he was the biggest issue with the Bills on Sunday night. I mean, last week, we talked about this. You asked me whether the Bills could sustain their formula from the first two rounds of the playoffs against the Chiefs. And I told you they couldn't count on continuing to win games the same way. My specific concern, I believe I mentioned, was that they needed to win games outside of the red zone. And that is the problem that popped up on Sunday night, Pablo. So during the regular season, the Bills were the fifth worst defense in football in the red zone. But in the first two games of the postseason, against the Colts and against the Ravens, they held those two teams to two touchdowns on eight trips inside the red zone, which is incredible. Probably won them those two games. Well, the Chiefs are playing a different sport than the Colts and the Ravens, if I'm being honest with you. And on Sunday, they scored touchdowns on each of their five trips inside the red zone. So from 2 out of 8 to 5 out of 5. And honestly, even more so than going 5 out of 5 and having that be meaningful, it's how easy those five touchdowns were. The closest the Bills came to a stop was Tre'Davious White attempting to ride Travis Kelce like a mechanical bull in coverage. But the refs flagged him for holding, and the Chiefs scored on, of all things, an underhanded shovel pass from Mahomes to Kelce on the next series.
They're going to fake the... They shovel it inside to Kelce, and he leaps and dives. Touchdown! Kansas City! A wrinkle!
You can't count on holding offenses, especially good offenses, to scoring touchdowns in the red zone 25% of the time. And when the Bills were not able to do that on defense, their offense was not able to hold up their end of the bargain and keep up in a shootout against the ultimate shootout team, the Kansas City Chiefs.
So let's turn from an underhand pass to a backhanded compliment for a second, because I did think the Bills were a lot better than this. And I wonder, Bill, when Buffalo dares to rewatch the tape of tonight, what are they going to see? What are they going to wish they'd done differently?
I think they're going to wish they tackled. I think they're going to wish they tackled Travis Kelce and Tyreek Hill. In the first game between these two teams, Pablo, the Bills had a really obvious and effective game plan. They took away all the big plays from the Chiefs. They played two deep safeties, and they said, okay, if you want to run the ball for 5 yards a carry, we will let you do that all day. This time things changed. They did play a lot of deep safeties, but they tried to mix things up more, tried to confuse Mahomes more, and started the game with Tre'Davious White on Tyreek Hill. White is an excellent cornerback, one of the five best corners in the league. But he was overmatched moving around the field against Hill. Last time, when the Bills played the Chiefs during the regular season, Hill had 3 catches for 20 yards. This time, he had 9 catches for 172 yards. Dramatic difference. Travis Kelce had 13 catches for 118 yards and 2 touchdowns. It was weirdly almost the total opposite of the last time these two teams played. This time, the Bills did a great job of stopping the run, but it didn't matter. The other problem is that Sean McDermott didn't seem to realize he was playing the league's most terrifying offense in a year where teams were scoring more points than ever before. The Bills went for a 4th-and-1 at midfield on the first drive of the game, and I felt like they had the right idea for a team playing the Chiefs. You have to go for it on 4th down. You can't settle for punts and field goals. You need to hold on to the football. You need to score touchdowns to win the game. Well, they actually did not have the game plan for doing that. The Bills were already trailing 21-9 at the end of the second quarter, but McDermott decided to kick a field goal on 4th-and-goal from the 2-yard line instead of going for a touchdown. Mm. On their next drive, down 24-12, with 9 more minutes of game time having elapsed, 9 minutes closer to the end of their season, the Bills faced a 4th-and-3 from the 8-yard line. And again, they sent out Tyler Bass and kicked a field goal to get back within 9. Pablo, you may notice they went from a 2-possession game to a 2-possession game by kicking those field goals. The Chiefs got the ball back. They hit a 71-yard pass to Hill 2 plays later.
Going to throw a slant, caught, 35-yard line. Juke move, Tyreek Hill, 45, 50-yard line, cuts it back, look out, 40, 35, 30, Cheetah at full speed, 10 to the 5-yard line. It's a 71-yard pass play to the Cheetah on a quick slant.
And the game was basically over as a contest.
I feel like if your kicker is your MVP, things probably aren't going great for you in a given football game, Bill.
It's either incredible and your kicker just had like the game of his life, like Adam Vinatieri in the snow 20 years ago.
Or
you've lost by 20 points and there's no middle ground.
So let's talk about the reigning Super Bowl MVP, Bill, because Patrick Mahomes did not seem to have any lingering issues really from his turf toe thing or his having been in the concussion protocol in the week prior. So what did you see from Mahomes as he basically strolled to a second straight Super Bowl?
I saw a guy who could have constructed a house in the pocket and lived there quite comfortably for a while until some of his receivers got open in this game. I mean, the Bills just did not get any pressure on Patrick Mahomes. He was pressured on just 20.5% of his dropbacks. And we know with Patrick Mahomes, you're not going to beat him that way. Since the start of 2018, when he took over as the starter for the Kansas City Chiefs, when teams pressure Mahomes less than 25% of the time, the Chiefs are 26-1. The Bills were not the one, unfortunately. Mm. And even when they did get pressure, even when they did get home, it didn't work. Last week against the Browns, Mahomes was 1 of 6 for 20 yards when he was pressured. This week, 5 of 7 for 66 yards and a touchdown. The toe injury, honestly, was a much bigger problem last week. Even before he left the game with the possible concussion, we saw Mahomes limping to the huddle after plays. He was sailing throws to the sidelines because he wasn't able to fully plant on that foot comfortably. This week, there was none of that. Mahomes looked close to 100%, and he wasn't missing throws anywhere near as frequently as he was against the Browns. He reportedly had a custom orthotic installed in his shoe to help with the issue, and if we're being honest, it's the NFL, he was probably likely given some shot before the game to deal with the pain. He should be 100% or pretty close to 100% for the Super Bowl 2 weeks from now.
So as we look forward to this Super Bowl and Chiefs-Bucks in Tampa Bay, we're going to beat the living hell out of the Mahomes versus Brady storyline. We're going to beat that thing into the earth's core for the next 2 weeks, Bill. So is this how you saw the final stretch of the season playing out? And what are you most looking forward to in that game?
I think I had Saints-Chiefs as my Super Bowl pick, so I get kind of half credit, but I picked the team that everyone picked to win the AFC, so I don't really deserve that much credit for that one.
A tough grader. You really are a tough grader on your
side. Just have to be honest. I did pick the Chiefs and the Bucks to win on Sunday, but that was honestly more because I want to see what happens if Bruce Arians makes it into the Super Bowl and wins it in his home stadium. Like there's like a 50% chance there will be an actual beer pong game on the pirate ship as the celebration is happening. There are so many fun storylines in this matchup, even beyond Brady versus Mahomes. You have Travis Kelce versus Rob Gronkowski. You have the one that really stood out to me, actually, after watching these games on Sunday, is Tom Brady versus Steve Spagnuolo, the defensive coordinator for the Chiefs, who 13 years ago happened to be the defensive coordinator for the New York Giants, who shut down Brady and the 18-0 Patriots in that year's Super Bowl. And weirdly, I know that I'm going to think about 8 million things about this game between now and two Sundays from now, but my initial thoughts about this matchup almost make it like the roles from that game have been reversed. Brady's Buccaneers can score. They're obviously capable on offense, but they're the ones on the other side of the field from the seemingly unstoppable offense of the Kansas City Chiefs. And while I don't think there's any stopping the Chiefs altogether, the Buccaneers are going to try and win by getting pressure with their front four, just like the Giants did against Brady and company in that Super Bowl upset. The Bucs were able to make havoc happen on Sunday with Shaq Barrett and Jason Pierre-Paul. And the Chiefs will be down their two starting tackles in the Super Bowl after Eric Fisher went down with an Achilles injury in the game on Sunday night. I have to admit, last year, I picked the Niners to beat the Chiefs. And I had to watch that entire game rooting against Patrick Mahomes to do crazy things. I can't do that to myself again. I can't sit there for 60 minutes expecting Patrick Mahomes not to be incredible. But as we start thinking about what might happen to make a Buccaneers upset happen in the Super Bowl, the possibilities for an upset start with the same ways the Giants were able to upset the Patriots 13 years ago. This time, though, Brady is on the side of the underdogs.
Bill Barnwell, thank you for joining us, and we'll see you in 2 weeks for your final exam.
My pick is subject to change. That is not binding.
Up next, we remember the life of Henry Aaron, who was so much more than baseball's home run king.
Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with a smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured, it was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo. Another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky. 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
Here's another story I want you to know. The most famous thing about Henry Aaron is a number. Because baseball reveres its home run record like the Vatican reveres the chair of St. Peter. And Hank Aaron was the man who hit 755 home runs. The man who had shattered Babe Ruth's record of 714 in 1974.
Here's the pitch by Downing. Swinging. There's a drive into left center field. That ball is going to be out of here. It's gone. It's 715. There's a new home run champion of all time, and it's Henry Aaron. The fireworks are going. Henry Aaron is coming around third. His teammates are at home plate, and listen to this crowd. The sellout crowd is cheering. Henry Aaron, the home run...
Making the man nicknamed the Hammer the home run king for more than three decades. But there is so much more to that basic chronology, and to Henry Aaron, who died on Friday at age 86. So we called Dr. Damian Thomas, the curator of sports at the National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, to learn more.
As a historian, you know, most people begin with baseball, but I actually go a different sort of route. I really think about it within the context of the civil rights movement. And I think about it from the standpoint of his involvement in the Negro Leagues. He was one of the last great Negro League players. We tend to think about Jackie Robinson, and when Jackie Robinson integrated, it was the decline of the Negro Leagues. But there was another generation of players who still had to get their start in the Negro Leagues because the last major league team didn't integrate till 1959. So I think about him as symbolic of that that post-Jackie Robinson generation of Negro League players. Also think about him in the context of the integration of the city of Atlanta, when the Braves moved from Milwaukee in 1966 down to Atlanta. It's only 2 years after the Civil Rights Bill got passed. And just at the beginning of Major League Baseball moving in to the Deep South. And what does that mean for a place like Atlanta, where it becomes sort of symbolic of integration in this new city, which would ultimately become seen as symbolic of the new South?
It's staggering, Dr. Thomas, to think about how in 66, when those Braves moved to Atlanta, that Henry Aaron became really the first Black sports star in the Deep South. How do you begin to relay to those unfamiliar with that time period and with that experience what that entailed?
It's still a battle. It's still a battleground. Even though the laws say that you can do these things, you have to have people who are willing to actually go do them. And I think it's true that a lot of people both celebrated and struggled with Hank Aaron's success. And one of the ways that we see people struggle with it is that as he's approaching the home run record, people start to try to change the meaning and significance of the home run record. Well, actually, maybe the RBI record is the most significant, or it's the hit record that matters more. And for years, a lot of publications put an asterisk by his home run record after he passed Babe Ruth. Well, they said, well, when Babe Ruth played, the teams only played 154 game season. So when he played, there was 162 game season, and so he had an unfair advantage.
And those delegitimizing efforts, Dr. Thomas, it's important to note, it came in the form of letters. He got something like 930,000 plus letters, so many of which were hateful and trying to intimidate the guy who was about to be this holder of the sacred record.
One of the parts of that story is that Hank held on to those letters. And so you can see in these letters an attempt to try to get him to leave the game, an attempt to intimidate him, to induce a certain level of fear that if he broke this record, it would lead to harm to his family and to others. And what's important to remember about this time, 1974, is just in about 10 years period, how many assassinations we had seen in the country over the issue of civil rights. John F. Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X. And so it's not something that he can't consider. And also, if we think about the larger history of lynching in America, the majority of African Americans who were lynched because of their economic prosperity, because of what their success represented. Mm. And so thinking about that recent history and that much longer arc of history, this was certainly something that would have caused Hank Aaron to think deeply about what he was doing and what it meant and how it could potentially lead to harm to him and his family. I'll tell you what, in our baseball case, we only had room for 3 jerseys to go in. It was difficult to think about the other 2, but Hank Aaron was certainly at the forefront of my thinking about which stories we wanted to be able to tell immediately.
Dr. Damian Thomas, thank you for telling the story of Hank Aaron with us on ESPN Daily.
It's my pleasure.
I'm Pablo Torre. This has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.